I turned pro at age 15 because at that time, like I said, it was a new sport. I started off racing in the beginners class and right away moved from, beginners to intermediate or novice and intermediate and then to expert. But then at 15, I had a pro class, and then at the local races, they were starting to get, like pro money, just collecting money from passing a hat around and getting from the fans and the families and stuff like that. And yeah, before we knew, we had a probably about $100 to $200 winners, a purse for a winner. So, and then they broke it down to like top three and stuff. So yeah, it was fun to race local racing and making money and making, maybe $100 to $200 at a small race. And so yeah, I was the youngest at that time, 15, to turn pro, because when I at 15, that's when they had the first pro class in BMX. And so from 19, I think it was 1975, I started racing. I was the youngest. And then at 1976, I got a factory sponsor from Mongoose. And, so Mongoose was my first, real contract. And that was in 1976.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Stable Cyclist Podcast. My name is JP, and we've got an exciting episode for you this week. One of the all-time goats of mountain biking in the United States of America, Tinker Juarez, is here today to chat with us about his career and his accomplishments and why he's still going. And before we get Tinker in here, I just want to start by thanking everyone who is listening and watching. This is our 10th episode only of the Stable Cyclist Podcast, and I have been blown away by how fast this has grown. And we have regular listeners all over the world, including places like Germany, United Kingdom, and Colombia. The podcast is growing because you are all doing an amazing job at sharing the podcast. And let's keep that going. While you're listening today, make sure to take a screenshot and do me a favor and tag the Stable Cyclist as well as today's guest, Tinker Juarez. You can find him on social at tinker.juarez and share that on your story so we can see who's listening and we can keep spreading the love around. This episode is brought to you by Flow Formulas. If you are training for a big race or if you're just training to be healthy, you want to be performing at your best each and every day. And you need Flow Formula's Endurance Mix and Recovery Mix as well. I am a super salty sweater, so for me, when I head to the Flow Formula's online store, I make sure to throw a bag of the high sodium mix into my cart. And if you've got a cart full of goodies ready to go with Flow Formula, you should use the code JohnPeter15 at checkout for a discount on that cart full of goodies. All right, enough of all of that. What you're here for today, let's get in the studio and talk with Tinker Juarez. Well, Tinker Juarez, welcome to the Stable Cyclist Podcast. It is an honor to be talking to you and having lined up next to you at the Mottohay 100 in the past. We'll get into that in later in the interview, but it's really good to see you, man. And yeah, I see you had a real good result over the weekend, and you getting your race season kicked off. So how are things getting started for you this year?
I think the season's going, it's starting off really good. Yeah, I just raced this past weekend, and it was a short race, an hour and a half. So I was really happy how I raced, and my time was really good. So I knew I had those. I knew I still had the speed. I just needed to, hope, have that good day, and it turned out being a good day.
Man, an hour and a half race for you these days must feel like a short track race compared to what you're typically doing in the ultra endurance world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't race cross country as much anymore, and I do just for the. Just to prepare myself for the World Championships Masters. Yeah, I'm just, I like racing a local race here in Temecula because it's got some good competition and the riders are fast. So, and it just helps me get ready for the Master World. So yeah, it was, I normally do marathons, but I just wanted to get more races in. So there happened to be a local race and cross country, and it happened to be a pretty big one. So yeah, so it was good to to get, yeah, good to check out my speed, and it went really well. So I was checking out my time, and I was comparing to the other guys' time, and I was, you know, my time was really good. I mean, there was a few guys that were beating me in the beginning of the season, and I compared my time with one of the guys, and I actually was faster than him. So it was cool to see that. So yeah, it was, yeah, I just need anything to keep boosting myself up.
So you are originally from the Los Angeles area. You're still in the Los Angeles area, and your background, everybody thinks about you today as this ultra endurance legend. And I want to kind of talk them through your career. And that means we're starting out with BMX. And how did you get into racing BMX at 13 years old?
Right, right. Well, you know, it was just, there was a park down my, down the road from my house, and I used to meet my friends after school, and there was a big, big dirt mound up there, and we kind of made it into a track, and we would, bring our shovels and stuff like every, you know, every day, and just kind of create a BMX track. And at that time there wasn't even a sport of BMX racing, but then, so the local guy at the park, he wanted to have a race there, and that's kind of, you know, I kind of started racing BMX there, and it was called, Hollyfield Park where I started. So we just got a bunch of friends, and we used to meet up there, and then eventually they made a race, you know, they had a race there, and I started racing there. And then there was, you know, then the sport just started, you know, started growing by having races in it all around town, different towns. So, yeah, I was able to travel, you know, just go on weekends and race locally. So I was doing that for, you know, that's kind of how my career started, just by racing a lot of local races.
Yeah, and you race BMX essentially as a pro, even though there's not really a pro division back then, because you're winning money quite often doing this.
I turned pro at age 15 because at that time, like I said, it was a new sport. I started off racing in the beginners class and right away moved from, you know, beginners to novice and intermediate and then to expert. But then at 15, I had a pro class. And then at the local races, they were starting to get, you know, like pro money, just collecting money from passing a hat around and getting from the fans and the families and stuff like that. And yeah, before we knew, we had probably about $100 to $200 winners, you know, a purse for a winner. So, and then they broke it down to like top three and stuff. So yeah, it was fun to race local racing and making money and making, you know, maybe $100 to $200 at a small race. And, so yeah, I was the youngest at that time, 15, to turn pro, because when I, at 15, that's when they had the first pro class in BMX. And so from 1975, I started racing. I was the youngest. And then at 1976, I got a factory sponsor from Mongoose. And, you know, so Mongoose was my first, you know, real contract. And that was in 1976. So, yeah, it was really exciting at that time.
Yeah. And you kind of rode the wave of BMX as it grew.
Right.
Through your early 20s as well, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, anything that was changing, I was there. And every year there was something new, and I would always get the new stuff and all the trick stuff. And then, yeah, as it grew, I grew with it. And the sport kept on growing, and I was able to travel all over the U.S. And the farthest I went to in the BMX race was Japan. I was there mainly for doing exhibitions, you know, cause it was a new sport. So we went to these places and we were showing the, you know, the riders there, you know, how to, you know, race around the course and stuff like that. So we were out there and, you know, just showing, you know, our skills and doing riding on their courses and just teaching the, you know, the kids back then about BMX. And so, you know, our team Mongoose was, our Mongoose team flew us out there, and they, and you know, so we were able to travel and, you know, and do these, invitations, you know, and stuff like that.
And so what happens around age 25? Because your results in BMX abruptly stop and fairly quickly I can start to find your name again in mountain bike results. Was it just discovering the mountain bike, or what happened?
Kind of what happened is after Mongoose, I rode for Mongoose for 6 years, and that was starting around 76. And then I went from 76 to, I think it was around 81 or 82. Mongoose just wanted to get new faces and change the team. And I started, then I ended up having to go and find smaller teams. And so I got picked up for a couple years after Mongoose, and I was riding for smaller companies like Bandito, JMC, or that's a two teams that I could remember. And there was a, yeah. And then from there, it was just smaller races I was doing. And then a company introduced me to this bike, and I think it was General Bicycles. And they, you know, they said, hey, check out this bike. And it was a mountain bike. And I go, wow, gears on the bike, you know, and BMX, we only had one gear, and we always had to go to certain races to change our front ring or our back gears, and we were always messing around with gears for the certain straightaways at BMX races, you know, so we wanted to have a fast gear. Sometimes the straightaways were really long, so we needed a little bit harder gear to be able to spin it all the way to those corners. And so mountain biking, they had all the gears on the bike, and I thought, this is great, you know, now I could ride and shift gears, and I was, you know, I was good, you know, mountain biking just started too, like BMX. It was a brand new sport. And there was, you know, we started with flat pedals, and I don't even think we even had toe straps at that moment. You know, heavy bikes, chromoly, and just handbrakes, and started racing some local stuff. And I just got out of BMX just right away. I just like, you know, I was, you know, getting old in that sport. And, you know, and so BMX was the doors just opened up, and I just took it, and I started off with like a company called General Bicycles, and they were just, the bikes were made in Taiwan, but it was a shop that was carrying these bikes, and they, you know, they started sponsoring me, and I was getting a small salary, kind of like a weekly salary, and that was kind of strange. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I just started, you know, racing mountain bikes, you know, and, you know, whatever races came up. And so they were all cross countries. There was really no long distance stuff. And so it was a good, you know, it was a good change for me because my skills were there. I had all the bike handling that you could, you know, you sure. needed for the sport, but I didn't have that endurance. And then as, you know, just right away, the sport started growing to bringing other riders, and the riders were mainly coming from the road, but they didn't have any skills. So so I just realized when I was in the sport that I needed to get the endurance in me. And I just started, you know, like getting road bikes, but didn't know anything about road bikes. I was really, you know, I mean, I got a bigger bike than I need, too big of a frame. I didn't know the sizes or any of that. So it was a learning, you know, learning lesson, but I learned quick. And like mountain bike, and we got to grow by seeing like shocks and then seeing clip-ins and then aluminum frames. And then from aluminum frames, you know, carbons came in late. It did come in late, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I did everything that was new on a bike that was mountain biking. Pretty much I got the trick stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk about the technology developments, and you're kind of riding the wave as it goes, as things like front suspension come in, as things like toe clips come in, and all of a sudden you're not getting bounced off the bike.
Right.
What was that like for you? Were you just like, what is this magic? Or were you like, yeah, let's go, you know?
Yeah.
What was that like for people that were experiencing it?
Well, for me, it was like, you know, I was still young and it felt really cool. You know, I mean, getting free stuff and then able to test stuff out and go, wow, this, you know, just seeing how it all worked out. I mean, you couldn't learn it all in 1 year. So every time you got something, it was like, you know, you're just barely learning something. And the next thing you know, something else cool came out. And so there was always something new. So it just kept the riding exciting. And, you know, as you're racing and getting all these cool stuff, you know, it's like next thing you know, another year comes by and then you're getting more new stuff. So it was just really, you know, then you're starting to experience and see what worked best for you and stuff like that. So, So yeah, it was, it was really nice. I mean, I was just excited trying new things just to get better, and that was my idea. Oh, this should work really good. And then I kind of knew what was good and what wasn't good. So
Yeah.
yeah, so it was, everything was just a learning thing, and it just helped you ride better and make you go faster. And as you're competing against guys that you knew were fast, you just wanted to see what was, what would work for you. So, I mean, it was really fun. I mean, everything was brand new, so you couldn't complain,
Yeah, how often were you able to find races back then, and how did you find races back then?
Yeah. Oh, well, it was mainly just through magazines, local, maybe like, I don't know. There was, you go to bike shops and they would have like weekly papers and stuff like that, and you would go to the back and there was like a list, oh, local races, or California, and there's Southern California, and then you look for these races like that. I was just kind of, I was new at it, so I just kind of, that was a way, or you just go by word from people, oh, did you hear about this race and things like that. So yeah, everything was just, like BMX, I learned how to go to local races and find them. And then it was sort of like you go into mountain bike, and it started kind of being the same way. You just go, okay, I could go there, or I could, that's too far, or that, and things like that. And so, yeah, it was just, you learn by, I was, from my sponsor, they also knew what races for me to go to too. So,
Sure.
they helped me out and they said, yeah, we'd like you to go to this. And I, yeah, of course, I would love to go, so I really had no reason to turn down races because it was, something new to me, and it was always more experience, So, yeah.
Let's talk pre-1996 Olympics, because that's the first
Oh.
time mountain biking is in the Olympics. Let's talk before then, because you really start mountain biking in the mid-80s, and so that's
Yeah,
a big
well,
chunk
like
of
I
time.
actually started in 86 mountain biking, and
Okay.
then I just went from straight out of mountain BMX, so straight into to mountain biking. And I, it was a good change because I had a sponsor right into the new sport of mountain biking.
Yeah.
And it was
Yeah.
like a, yeah.
How much were you traveling pre-Olympics? Were you
Right.
traveling mainly still in the United States, or were you starting to get into these stage races already, or did those things not exist at that time?
I did. I was racing with like with as I got close to the Olympic, I was racing for like Klein bicycles, and I was doing a lot of traveling. Mainly I wasn't really traveling overseas. I was just traveling in the U.S., so I would travel back east and stuff like that. And I was doing all, there was all these Norba Nationals and things like that. So I started racing the Norba National when that came out in the scene, and then there was they had a series, and that race series became, something I was chasing after. So yeah, so racing Norba was kind of like the start of my racing career, because Norba had like up to maybe 8 or 9 nationals back then, and all those nationals were all in different states and things. So I was able to travel like that, and so that's, what Klein was able to do. They were paying my expenses to go to these races. Yeah, and I mean, I started off with, usually I started off with a good team, and Klein was a good team to, it was a great bike. It was, really an awesome bike. It was light. It was already, the technology that they had was amazing, because it would look like a heavy bike because it had these big tubings. But then it was just really light, and when you're bonds, going down trails and stuff, you're able just to let the bike absorb the dirt. It wasn't, you weren't bouncing around because it was so light, and you just learn how to use your hands to just be more, more, not so tight, not so tense, and just let the bike do all the, bouncing and stuff like that. And so it was really amazing. The bike didn't really lose control when you're really bonzoing, going down all these rough trails. And this was out to suspension and stuff. So, I mean, so yeah, it was really exciting, at that time. And right around 94 is when I got a phone call. And that phone call was from Tom Schuller. And that was when they put together this Volvo Cannondale team. And that was right when I had the choice of staying with Kleiner then, but the offer was just mind blowing. It was like, you know, it was over $100,000 or something like that. I think the very beginning of my career, I never, you know, in my wildest dream was ever thinking I was going to make that kind of money. So it was sort of like, all right, I'll definitely join the team. So it was a really, it was an offer you could never refuse, you know, as a racer.
You signed this big deal with Cannondale.
Yep.
Right on the eve of the Olympics, essentially, a year or two out from then. The 96 Olympics is the first time we have mountain biking in Olympic Games.
Right.
I'm not really interested in like how you did there, or hearing about that. I want to know how you felt and how excited you were to be like, we're going to do this sport in the Olympics and I'm one of the people.
Yeah. Oh man. It was really exciting for sure. You know, for me, it was like a dream come true. I've never ever thought a bike would be, you know, me racing Olympic. That was like something that I never even thought would happen. And to be the first American to be, you know, to qualify for the Olympics was actually a really big deal too. And that was exciting because there was only two Americans that went. And so I was at that time at my, you know, I was really at my, you know, at going at my peak. You know, I was at my best racing in career. I mean, I won like the Norba title. So that was an automatic, almost making it to the US team. And plus all the UCI races I was doing, I was top American in points. And, you know, my results were, you know, probably better than all the Americans to make the team. So, it was a really, it was quite nervous because they were putting a lot of, like, I haven't even got to the Olympics and I was like getting into magazines and all this stuff. And I was like, you know, I haven't even put a result up, but they were like making me act like I was going to win the Olympics. And I go, so that was quite a bit of pressure as the, right there. Because I haven't even got to the Olympics and I'm like making magazines, best American going to the Olympics and all that. So that was right there. I think it kind of was putting a huge amount of pressure on me because, you know, now they think I'm going to win the Olympics, you know, before I even got to the Olympics. So, but it was, you know, I mean, it was really, really awesome feeling. You know, that's all I could really say. You know,
how did you deal with all that pressure of seeing yourself in these magazines and this expectation that you were feeling towards you and what you were supposed to do? Did you just internalize that or have people to talk to about it? Or how did you work through that?
I don't think I really handled it so well. Honestly, it was a lot of pressure and I didn't really have, you know, anybody to put my, you know, answer, you know, how can I handle this better and things like that. So I just had to just do it, you know, like going to another race, but, you know, instead of another race, the biggest, you know, biggest event in the world. It was really hard. I mean, I honestly didn't know how to really handle it. So I just kind of just, you know, it just really was this nervous, you know, a lot of pressure was, I could definitely feel it. You know, and, but I wasn't getting pressure from my team or anything like that. They weren't like, you know, expecting a lot out of me or anything, but it was just really, to think that I'm going to Olympics and, you know, it was a lot of pressure. So I don't think I really handled it so well. I wish I would have had someone to really guide me into it a little bit, make me more relaxed about it and, you know, get coached, even, you know, be able to handle it better. But they just thought I had it under control and it was really something I didn't, you know, really speak up or anything about it. I just, you know, well, you know, here we go.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Did you do anything different going into 2000? And maybe you didn't feel like the expectations were quite the same because it was in Australia versus the United States, but right. How did you approach that Olympic Games differently?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot different because, first of all, there was everybody that seen the first Olympic mountain bikers were really focused on the next one. They, you know, they seen how great that was. And now, you know, they see this big opportunity to make the Olympics. So it was definitely a lot harder, first of all, just to qualify for the Olympics because there was more riders that were all hungry to want to make that, you know, make that team. The U.S. team. And so, yeah, it was, you know, just that itself was a challenge just to try to make it. So I had a good, you know, some good competitors that were really, you know, it was really, it was kind of like a decision, you know, are we going to take Tinker or are we going to take this guy or whatever? Because it was so close in points. It was actually, I think it was, I forget his name at the moment, Steve Larson. Steve Larson at that time was my big threat. And we were literally, but it was either we both were going to make it, but we didn't know for sure who, you know, if they were going to take one American or two Americans. So it was a battle. I mean, we were looking at the points at every race. I mean, it was coming that close to where we went to UCI, even if we didn't win, you know, like if we placed 10th and he placed 14th, or, you know, those points, you know, were, you know, 10th is better than 14th. So we were like even looking at our results, you know, no matter if we won, you know, how, you know, what place did we finish? And it was that close. I mean, and it, but, you know, I got called to be able to make it. And I think it was Steve Larson. He didn't make it for some reason. It was so close. But, you know, I made it, you know, instead of him. And I think it was either Don Myra or, no, I think Don Myra was at the first Olympic. I think it was Travis Brown at rode for track at the time. I think it was me and Travis that might have made it. So, yeah. And I don't know what, you know, it was, I just knew that Steve Larson, whatever happened, he came in fire after the Olympics, and his training plans kind of was, it kind of happened too late. He didn't prepare for it. It all kind of came up too late. He just, you know, his training like came after. It seemed like he trained it either too soon or too late or something where he just missed it. So he was after the Olympics, you know, he was on fire the rest of the season. It was like, and it was a bummer that he didn't, you know, wasn't able to make that training earlier so he could have been on, you know, better focus for the Olympics. But, you know, that is the way it goes, you know.
Yeah. So after the Olympics in 2000, your results kind of, there's a big shift from going cross country to more of the ultra endurance to the marathon side of things.
Yeah.
And we start seeing your first 24 hour results popping up in 2001. What caused that shift to move away from cross country and start doing more of the marathon and even the 24 hour stuff?
Well, what I've seen is that now more riders are getting faster. And so after the second Olympics, you know, this riders just, you know, are just starting to get better. There was more riders getting, you know, getting into the sport, and my results were not as good. So I had to really, I had to see what I had, you know, to do to get better, and got lucky that there was these other new sports that started coming into it. And it was 24-hour racing, and I started, you know, seeing it pop up in the magazine. I go, wow, you know, these races are getting enough attention to make the magazine. Man, I better start seeing if, you know, because I always loved training. I always liked training long. So now my longer trainings were not really working so good for the cross country. And I wasn't as, you know, I was losing that speed or whatever it was. And I wasn't winning the races the way I used to win. So the endurance just, you know, the 24 hours just came in just in time. And my sponsor just were happy to say, yeah, go for it. And they were just liking what my, you know, what I was, you know, focusing on now. And they were, you know, so that gave me motivation to, you know, now to, you know, focus on long distance racing. And it was the 24 hours they already started, but, you know, and I started reading these different riders. And so I thought, okay, now is the time to join, you know, start racing 24 hours. And so I did, and it was a, you know, it was a good time to do it. It was a lot of races to choose from, and I was able to get, you know, enough races for the year to do. And so, yeah, so I started just doing that, and my sponsors were able to, you know, they were psyched about it. So I was able to continue with the contract, you know, because of that.
How big of a mind shift was it going from the cross country where it's just like wide open to the 24 hour racing where it's still pretty wide open, but you're doing it for such a long time? What was the mentality like, and shifting into that different mentality?
It was, I don't know, for me, because I was so good. I loved training long and I loved riding, training hard. So the 24 hours just worked out just, better for me because it was what I like to do. I like to ride my bike. And so riding my bike all day, let's do it. And so my mind was set to ride my bike and I knew I had the endurance in me and I used to train all the time, hard. So now I could be able to now put my, my race, my training into the 24 hours. So the mindset for me was good because I was just learning how to get into endurance and learn how to train along. And so my legs haven't had that, that enough, enough burnout time. So it was all like exciting. So I was able to be able to train long distance and recover after them and then continue to do another race. And so I was up to like four or five races a year doing 24 hours, and that was a lot at that time. And my recovery was not bad either. I mean, I was needed time off the bike, but I wasn't really off the bike. I was just mainly just riding but not riding hard. And so, yeah, it's just to rest up. So I didn't have to train a lot to be ready for my next one because I already had enough miles in my legs to continue to focus for the other races to come. So, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So you win four national 24-hour championships. But probably the most notable thing aside from the Mata-Hay that I want to talk to you about is you win the world championships at 24 hours in 2007 in Monterrey.
Right.
And you know that I'm good friends with Kelly McGelkey, and I've heard his side of what that day is like, or not necessarily his side, but his take on what that day was like. And I've read a lot of stories about it. It was 100 degrees at the start. You're doing 13 mile laps, and there's 2,500 feet of climbing. And Kelly leads the whole way until the last lap. And
Right.
then you're able
It's
to
hard to
attack
believe. It's
really hard. And
Yeah, it was really surprisingly. Yeah, sorry for cutting in, but
no, you're good. I want to hear about the whole day. I want to hear
well,
about the
I can't
race.
really tell you about. I mean, I don't know. I wish I could remember all my races, but I am definitely every time I get done with any race, I think about the next race and forget about the race behind me. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, but as far as as far as me and Kelly, I knew that my good friend Ed, as he used to come with me to a lot of my races. He was always helping me out, and he just couldn't believe that last lap. I mean, first of all, when we were at the night, it was even hard to know if he was going or not going, and and to stay up with Kelly during the night. I would kind of like, did he go yet? Did he go yet? And I was like asking my team because it was dark. And we didn't know exactly when he took off and stuff. So I was always like nervous about him getting away. And so that was kind of a challenge in itself during the night just to stay with him because we would come into the pit. I wouldn't know if he was going to stay in for a minute or go out right away or sneak away or do something. But somehow we hung together and he, really wanted to, to lead the whole race. And for me, I just think, well, if he could lead the whole race and if I could follow him, then I'm going to follow him. So he, it's kind of his style. His style is always, if he wants, he likes to be out in front, bottom line,
Yep.
and
Yep.
if he likes to be out in front, I like to be behind him. And so, yeah, I have to just, so I stayed behind him, but I just, whatever happened on that final lap, I just knew that I was on fire. I just, got this energy from nowhere, and I just took off on that last lap. And when you look back and you don't see your rider starting to like hang with you, that just gives you more energy. You don't have no energy, but you can find it. It's that adrenaline that just kicks in. And I just took off and never looked back. And it looked like I was like taking off on my first lap on that final 23 hours or 22 hours, whatever it was. So yeah, and it came from all the all those racing that you have done before that, preparing for the 24-hour world. Everything just kind of all hits you at one time at that that moment to want to win that Worlds, and it all just, you know, kind of sunk in at that moment, and everything just went perfect. So, I was, it was definitely one that I really wanted, and it was nice to be able to win, and, you know, so.
And you've won two other world titles as well as a masters division, correct? One of them was at Mount St. Anne, and where's the other one at?
Yeah, I won three. So I won my first master world championship was in Brazil. And that was when I first did my masters world championship. So I thought, well, this would be good to try to win a rainbow jersey that I never won in cross country. Now I can maybe do it at least in Masters. And for as long as I, you know, haven't never raced Masters, it was amazing how big Master is and how tough the competition is. And so I went into this sport with this sport been there for a long time. So for me to get into it, there was a lot of good competition at that time, you know, at that age. So it's really good to see that they have this Master World Championship. So when I did it, I won it in Brazil. And it was my first world, my first cross-country Masters world. Then I won it in, Mount St. Anne. And what was nice about that one in Mount St. Anne, I forget the year, but my first world champion or my first World Cup win was in Mount St. Anne. My very first ever winning a World Cup in my elite class was in Mount St. Anne. And then who knows how long later it was. I'm back to Mount St. Anne. Of course, I don't think I know the venue and stuff, but I don't remember what course I raced in the cross country when I did win that year. But it's just being in the same resort and everything. And then I ended up, I got lucky because the guy that was ahead of me, he got a puncture, but he was able to get a wheel change because he had a pit with wheels there, you know, waiting for him. But once I knew he was slowing down and I looked at the rear back of his tire, I just like, oh, he got a flat. Now I just went full gas, and it was towards the end of the race and it was a drag, but I still won his racing. And then to win the Worlds again, and, you know, World Championship in Mount St. Anne, that was really it was really special because to win my first ever cross country and to win my Masters World Champion here was really something to always never forget, you know. I'll never forget that because of, you know, being in Mount St. Anne in Canada. And so,
sure.
Yeah. And then my third one was in France. And that was another cross country is always hard because in the Masters, it's so short that the guys are always right there because you cannot, it's hard to get a gap on a track that's less than 4 miles, you know. And yeah. It's just, you're on the gas and there are guys that are so close, but it was a close battle to win the one in France. And it was a long journey to get there. And it's a crazy journey, but it's another story. But we finally got all the way to the Alps and we went from Brazil, from Spain, Barcelona, all the way to the Alps driving. It was a long, long drive to get there. But, you know, we won that race. It was a special moment to win something that took us forever to get there. But we made it, and we got to the cross of the finish line. And my good friend Manolo that drove all the way and set it up. You know, this guy is like my brother in Spain. And he really, you know, without his help, I would have never had a chance to even win that race in France. But, so three worlds. And actually, I'm going to be trying to go for it again this year. I'm set to go to Australia to race the world. And
awesome.
I got my ticket and I just signed up not too long ago. So it's in May. So it's coming up. So I'm okay. Really psyched. Yeah, I'm really psyched.
Yeah, that'll be amazing.
Yeah.
So amidst all this super long distance 24-hour stuff,
right.
And you're chasing the Masters world titles, you find yourself in Western North Dakota at the Mata Hay 100.
Right.
And I am wanting to know how you ended up out there. And then I think once you were there, you kept coming back because Nick is a great host. It's a great race. It's a beautiful
right.
place. But I want to know how you got there to begin with.
Well, I honestly think I heard this from Kelly somewhere before before I seen him at North Dakota. I think somehow I raced him or something that he told me, "Oh, you should ever, if you ever get a chance, do Montehay." And he was the one that was winning the races from the beginning, and I was always in a hunt of trying to get promoters to fly me to their race, and I got lucky to contact the promoter in Montehay, and it was Nick, and then Nick was nice and said, "We would love to have you, let me know whatever it takes, we'll get you here." And that's kind of how it started. So I had a race to put in my calendar for the year, and that was, Montehay for that month. And then Nick was so nice, to invite me that, he took care of me the whole time I was there. So it was really a treat. And so I got to, stay at a hotel then. Then I heard all the stories, with Nick's side, and his girlfriend's father owns a hotel, and on. So I got to learn a lot about Nick's whole family, and it was really a really nice story, because there was, he's had so many, there was just so many people involved in, in Nick's life that, once he, yeah. So it kind of just, once I got to really like Nick, and Nick liked me, and he loved having me in his race, and his race was really a cool race. This, the work that he put to put the race on, it was just a nice story in itself. And then the people were super nice, and I never thought of North Dakota being so much fun, but I've never ridden a course that was 100 miles almost of all single track. I mean, and literally you can minus maybe 5 miles of just open road at the whole entire race, but I have never done a race that's literally point to point 100 miles of all single track. If mountain biking is all about riding single track, so everybody wants to buy a mountain bike that are just recreation people going out on weekends. They want to ride single track. They don't want to ride fire roads. They don't want to ride anything that's boring. They want to go downhill or ride fun single track. And this had it all. I mean, this was one long roller coaster from point to point. It was a ride that you get a ticket, and you get that ticket to ride this 100 miles, and you have the most fun of your whole life for, 9 hours of riding single track. So, and after every time I say that, I always say, once I, after this race, I don't need to practice single track for the whole year. I'll just ride road, So yeah, it was really a dream. And what's fun about it is that it's a fun single track. It's like a, hey Josh, it's like love your haircut. My son just walked in. He was say
Hello.
hello, John, right?
So John.
Right, John?
Hey man.
This is my son Joshua. He just got a
Right
haircut.
on, man.
That's
Yeah.
me.
All right. He just walked.
This is a podcast, correct? Oh, this is a podcast.
Yeah. So yeah, he's a big kid.
You were at the race this past year, right, man?
He did come.
Yeah, I did. Wait, which one?
The Montehay.
Monet? Yeah, I was there. I was there. I was
Yeah.
there.
And he got
Right
to
on, man.
see me suffer. He never seen me. I told him I haven't suffered that hard in a long time, and I literally suffered. And he was there that gave me the motivation to
Oh,
finish.
yeah.
So that gave me even extra suffering. So I really stuck it out. But it was, without him there, I don't know if I would have had the drive to have made it. But I knew that if I didn't make it, I would have never seen his face at the finish line until somewhere getting picked up on the ground, laying somewhere dead. But yeah, he gave me the spark to get done, and I was happy that he went and he see me. There's good times and bad times, and he just see me at a bad time, and now he knows that what it takes to sacrifice when you're really, hurting. So he got to see me sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was dope. It's great to see you push
Yeah,
that
thanks.
hard.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, so anyway, sorry about that, but had to
No,
introduce
you're
myself.
good, man. Of
Yeah.
course. Of course.
Yep.
Yeah. So you go to the race. I believe the first time you go there is in 2017, and it was shortened that year because of the rain.
Oh, right. Yep.
And then in 18, you came back, you beat Kelly, and you get the course record. 2019, like I said, you and I line up actually next to each other on the start line. You go in again. The heat ate me alive that year.
Yeah.
2020, you and Josh Testato battle. 2021, you and Kelly battle again, and he gets course record, and you help him get the win that day. Why do you keep coming back? Because some people might see your results and think, oh, it's going really well for you. It's still a hard race. It's such a hard race. So what keeps bringing you back, man?
Well, I love North Dakota. And I love Nick as a great friend. He became super nice to me, you know, and he treats me well. And really, when you get invited now to any race, you know, it's rare. It doesn't happen all the time. So I'm really just thankful to have, you know, Nick invite me to his races, first of all. And then it's not an easy race. So I'm not going to just go and cherry pick a race. It's going to be a hard earning race to try to win. And, you know, you have to come in being fully confident and being riding really well to do this race. And so, yeah, so it's not, you know, and it's definitely going to continue to help me stay strong for the rest of the season. So, you know, I'm not going to go, oh, why did I do this race? Because now I feel slower. No, it's going to keep my fitness up. I have to be fit to be going there, first of all. And then after I finish that, if I do recover well and finish the season, I'll have good fitness for the rest of the season. So, it's a really good choice for me to do in my calendar of racing. And then there's,
why is the race so hard?
I think because of the concentration that you have to put the whole entire race. There's a lot of races where you're on Jeep roads and stuff. And, you know, you don't have to focus on, you know, the straightaways, you know, it's hard. But in Monterey, you got to focus on just staying on this tiny trail for, you know, 8 or 9 hours. So your mind is always concentrating on the single track trail. And you don't really have time to just take your mind off, maybe going uphill. But you're still got to stay on a tiny trail. And so you always got to focus on staying on this trail the whole entire race. And I think that right there, and then you have these gates that you have to lift up, and these gates become heavier than heavier as you go on. And so I think that is, I think it's mainly just having that mental focus for a whole entire race, you know, where in a lot of races, you don't have to put that much energy on a track. I mean, it's a different kind of focus on some races, you know. Some races, it's just a Jeep road, and maybe, you know, it's just different, you know, because of that. It's mainly because of the focus. You have to stay on the trail. You got to ride all the trails at a certain speed. You can't break too much. You got to flow with the trails all the time, and that means that you got to always stay on the gas. And as soon as you make bobbles and turns and stuff, then that takes energy away. And then you start to get frustrated because you're making too many mistakes. So it's really just trying to have a good rhythm entire race. And that makes it hard. I think, you know.
What is a person, like if you were going to talk to somebody who's never done the race before, and they ask you, what do I have to do to be successful at that race? What would your advice be to them?
Mainly just to be focused on a single track. You know, like I was saying, it's all about single track racing. And you know, if they're not good at single track, they're going to be in trouble because they're going to be using their brakes too hard, and they're not going to be able to shift correctly. They're going to overshift, or you know, like. You don't have to shift a lot on this track because you should be running on your top gears, your harder gears. And then, you know, when you start to climbing, you know, you're going to be shifting quicker and, you know, quickly because they're just the hills just come straight up. They're not like flat climbing, you know, so you got to be prepared for that, you know, like that different quick change from fast to going straight up. And then you have to have that good recovery going right back to, you know, back into the single track and again and again. So it's just mainly just be focused for a long day of all single track and, you know, try to be light on your brakes as possible, you know? But I always tell them that it's a good race because it's everything is done. I mean, the track is easy to figure out. It's following these wooden posts all the way, and you'll see them for miles and miles. And but we for some reason we still could get me and Kelly have made mistakes, and we catch ourselves right away because we've done it for so long. But most guys, if they don't really, if they miss a turn and stuff, you could literally go for a while and keep on going on a trail that looks like it's the same track, because they all look the same once you ride them for a while. So yeah.
So one of the questions that I, as I was producing the Mata-Hay documentary this year, and people then think I like have all the answers about the trail. One question I get all the time is, why does Tinker ride a hardtail out here? And I tell him, I'm like, I know he has a full suspension because I see it on Instagram, but I don't see you race it very often. You're mostly on a hardtail. Why do you like that bike so much?
I'm old school mainly, and I've always started with a hardtail, and I've always raced a hardtail. And I mean, I'll race some of the gnarliest tracks that are, around in the world almost, and you'll see me on a hardtail then. I've just mainly because it's just a lighter bike. Probably my number one reason is just lighter. It means to me it's faster. Yeah, now I'm gonna get the punishment out there on a lot of technical stuff. But I know how to handle the technical stuff. I have to focus a little bit more than most of the guys in full suspension. I have to really focus on the smoothest line on a technical course, where a lot of guys in full suspension don't have to focus that hard on the technical stuff. So that right there makes it more challenging because, I'm not on a full suspension. I got to always know that, and I always know anything that's hard. Just because they're able to ride it doesn't mean you're going to be able to ride it as smooth as they are. And so, I've just learned how to be able to take the punishment from a full, on rough course. But, now that the full suspensions are pretty similar, like they're close in weight, I would say probably maybe 1 pound to 2 pounds difference. It's still a lot, but, on some races, it definitely would probably, it would make sense to be on a full suspension. But, a lot of races that I pick are pretty good for hardtails. They're not saying they're better, but I could handle them. So I don't know. I'm just I'm still I my back doesn't bother me. I'm not not walking where I can't handle it anymore. Every time I hear somebody talk about a suspension, I go, man, I'm tired of riding a hardtail because my back is messed up. Or this something to do with their back or their body. And I really haven't seen those, I haven't had those complaints to be able to go, you know what, I cannot ride a hardtail anymore. So, but yeah, so, but I'm gonna start because now I'm on a, master's division class. I could ride a full suspension and still probably win the races, no different. And, yeah, so I'm not in the elite class where I don't, weight used to have been an issue. But now I think I could win on any bike. But I'm still, I'm hoping that Zero Uno is supposed to be coming out with a signature bike. This is my dream. This is what we've talked about over the winter. So I'm honestly waiting for it. I don't, I haven't found out what's taking it, why it's taking long, but all I know is that I'm gonna have a signature hardtail bike, and and that's not the reason why I'm still riding a hardtail, is that they're making a signature bike on a hardtail, so I'm excited about that to promote this bike once I get it.
Yeah, you have a really good relationship with Zero Uno, it seems. It's allowed you to keep racing.
Well.
One
Yeah, it's a new relationship, honestly, because last year I was
right,
riding with
correct.
I was riding with Floyd of Floyd of Leadville for 2 years, and they were able to get just a bike sponsor for me last year. So the only thing that Zero Uno got me was just a frame, frame and
Okay.
fork. So, but I was still, I wasn't anything else with Zero Uno. They just gave me a bike, and that was it. And but they didn't give the other guys, the other team riders on Floyd, because none of them were really a mountain biker, and they all wanted, you know. And I think Zero Owners just said, you know what, we could give Tinker a bike, but sorry, we can't give the whole team bikes. So I was excited that they gave me the only guy on the team to get a bike from Zero Uno. But I told them, you know, that there's a good chance I won't be riding with Floyd because there's been a lot of problems. And so with that, they, you know, we made an agreement that you know, yeah, we'll fully sponsor you this year if, you know, if you don't ride with Floyd. So that's how it all started, you know. So now I'm just waiting for bikes.
You might say, I don't want to talk about this. I totally respect that. I think a lot of times people say, or people have said to me, why do you have pros on? I don't have a lot in common with pros. And I always look for ways that we are in common, whether we're professionals or not.
Right.
I think one of the most real things that you have gone through and explained was you had a really long relationship with Cannondale that ended abruptly and surprisingly.
Right.
And I think it was some of your more real, like, human responses that we've seen. You know, you were not like this robotic racer that we all admire. You were this, like, very real person about, like, I had this relationship and it ended in a way that I wasn't happy with. You said earlier that you had a sponsorship end and it kind of pushed you towards thinking about mountain biking when you were in BMX. This relationship ends. It was really hard on you. From the outside, it appeared. And yet you're still here racing. Right. And so how did you work through that? And how did you decide to keep doing this thing? Because I think that's most relatable to everybody listening.
Yeah. Well, it was a shock to me big time. You know, it was shocking that they just kind of let me go the way they did. It was just a phone call. Hey, you know, and it was almost like, you know, we don't need you no more. And it's like, you know, well, you know, go ahead. And, you know, it was sort of like that. We don't need you no more. We've done everything we could possibly do with you. And that was it. I just, like, was shocked to hear those words. But it doesn't, you know, the company changed in a, you know, a 360. They've completely let all the best people from Cannondale in the beginning when I was with Volvo Cannondale. So probably half of those years, half that 27 years was the best years with Cannondale. And the second half with new people running the business and new corporation and all is about money and this stuff, you know. I didn't even know if I had a team with Cannondale every year because I had nobody to talk to that was really wanting to like be on my side on the company. I really didn't have I might have had someone that, you know, that I talked to monthly, but he wasn't, you know, like, it wasn't like a friendly kind of conversation where I did like with Cannondale. There was like a family back in the days. And now it's like, you know, I don't even know who I talked to find out if I have a contract next year. So when I seen everybody getting let off, I'm thinking, why them? Why not me? You know, why am I still on the team? And why did they let all these great people go? And then surprisingly, you know, it caught up and then it was me. And yeah, so to end the story, I just, you know, I done every, my best life in racing was with Cannondale. So I will never forget that. You know, it was just the way they did it. They could have done it a lot more professionally. You know, hey, Tinker, you know, we're going to let you go at the end of the year. Something like that would have been better than just phone call and just saying, hey, you know, we're done with you. So, you know, of course, and I'm going to be angry and I'm going to be like my heart just hit the ground. And so, yes, but, you know, it was amazing the people, the support that I got after that happened. And with that, it just started giving me a little bit more motivation. Then when probably the nicest thing that I got out of Floyd's team, you know, not being mean, but, you know, they had a lot of promises they didn't stay with. But the best phone call that I ever got was when Floyd called me after he heard about me. Once I heard that, you know, Cannondale dumped me, Floyd said, man, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry that this happened to you, Tinker, man. I really wish I could do something. You let me know if there's anything I could do for you. And I go, wow. You know, and he says, you know, we're going to, pretty much he wanted to start a team because he did not have even a mountain bike team. And he started this team because he said, I want to do anything to, you know, anything to help you. He goes, if it's money, I'll take care of you. you know, whatever Cannondale was doing, I'll do the same. It was sort of like that conversation over the phone was like, this is shocking. First of all, I know Floyd, but I've never talked to Floyd. And, you know, so Floyd, you know, I raced him in mountain biking back in the early, you know, when he started mountain biking. And we had, you know, good battles back then. But for him to give me that phone call was just like a really dream come true. And after that dream came true, at the end of the whole, after 2 years with Floyd, I really lost my love for Floyd after what happened with the team, because it was sort of like a nightmare, because all the promises that was promised on that one phone call, it never happened after that. So it was, but I do love him for being, you know, giving him that phone call, because it really meant a lot to me. And he did start a team, and the first year was a little rocky, but I still, okay, I'm going to stick it out another year. And then that next year was just, it was horrible. So it was, but yeah, so that drive gave me motivation to stick with it. And, you know, having Floyd to, you know, have a team that year, the first year was okay. But like I said, after that, I didn't, you know, have anything to jump on. So I had no choice but to stick with them. And then, you know, and then after that, you know, my career, I'm like 62. And so I thought, well, you know what, you got a house over your head. You know, it's not the end of the world. You can still race bikes. You know, people still want you to come to the races. You know, you'll find something and something will come together. And, you know, and I just stuck with it. I figure I have nothing to lose, you know. And I've done the sport my whole entire life. I always dreamed of having my least something out of the sport besides just a racer. But maybe Zero Uno might give me this answer, and having a signature bike, you know, I'm thinking this is cool. You know, hey, you know, 55, 56, 58 years of racing, you got a signature bike. That's, you know, that's better than nothing, you know, so yeah. So I'm at least excited about, you know, able to push a new brand and my first brand, and I could go to races, and now I could kind of show this off after, you know, for people to see and maybe people to buy and want.
You mentioned you are 62 years old.
Well, actually, I turned 63.
I know from...
I'm 63 now. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. You're 63 now.
Yeah.
Oh, my bad. Yeah. No, but I hear so many people when I'm at the Matahe, when I'm at these Matahe film premieres.
Right.
And they talk about how inspired they are by you because you're still doing this and you're still going at it at a high level. And as you inspire all these people, my last question is, what is inspiring you to keep doing this? What makes you get up in the morning and do this?
Yeah. Like you said, expiring, you know, I always get comments from people going, stay with the Tinker. You know, I have fans on, you know, on Facebook and Instagram that they love that I'm still doing it. And when you read, you know, read these over and over every single day, it's just like, you know, why should I stop now? Because I get people that are just starting bike riding and they're like 40 or 50 and they go, man, I look up to you. I said, don't give up, man. I said, I started riding my bike because of you. And I'm, you know, I thought it was too late in their career and they thought it was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. But now they see me, it's like an extra motivation. And so I have so many fans that really send me the most coolest things. And those little things are, they stick with me in my heart. And those are the things that keep me driving, you know, just reading just the things that how they, you know, they tell me about, man, I remember seeing you in the magazines when I started racing mountain biking, and these guys do not ride anymore, but then they see me still doing it. And it's just like, it's incredible to them. So, you know, I just think the Lord, first of all, for giving me the strength and the confidence and the power to do what I do. I honestly believe without him, the man upstairs, that I wouldn't be here today. I thank God every day for just giving me the power and just to be able to do it. And, you know, and to be able to say I'm doing it for a living. It's just, you know, what more, you know, that's the motivation that I need. It's just, you know, having, you know, whenever God thinks it's done, then it's over. But at the moment, he's like gave me fire to keep on going. And I really don't see any time or any reason why I should motivate. When I see when I sign up in the Masters category in the World Championship, and I see a guy up there, a 70-year-old, 70 plus racing in a cross country, I go, I'm going to be just like that guy. I want to race until I'm 70. So yeah, we have to set a motivation for kids that are coming in. You know, I want to set an example, a perfect example that it's never too late. And that's kind of like the coolest thing to say. It's never too late. If I could do it, you could definitely do it. And I want to continue to do it because it'll always give, you know, somebody else motivation to do it.
What an amazing ending, Tinker.
Thank you
for hanging out with us today and just sharing so much of your story.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I hope that I answered most of it pretty good. I'm not good at this, but I figure, hey, who's going to tell me that I'm not, you know? So except myself. So anyways, I did the best I can, you know, and I'm just happy that you asked me to do this. It was really an honor. So thank you for asking me to do this. You know, my son was excited. I told him that, hey, I got a podcast. You do? And, you know, to them, he knows how big of a deal that is. To me, it's like, I'm just going to do a talk. And, you know, I'll literally see, you know, somewhere in my life, I'll think about, man, that was so cool that I did a podcast, you know. And it is cool. I'm really thankful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And all this has been is just a long conversation, Tinker, and you've been awesome at it. So,
all right.
Tinker Juarez, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening today. If you are looking for more content, head on over to the Stable Cyclist YouTube channel, where you can find the film, Madahe, where you will find Tinker sprinkled throughout it, as well as Kelly Magelke and Tyler Huber's amazing story from this past year at the Madahe 100. You can find me on Instagram at the Stable Cyclist. Stable Cyclist Podcast is a twice monthly show that focuses on bikes, mentality, and when it feels right, we'll even dive deep into mental health. Episodes will always drop on the first and third Friday of each and every month, but keep your eyes peeled because we'll also have bonus episodes from time to time. Thanks for listening today and hanging out, and most importantly, above everything, remember, you are loved.